Welcome to ITE 1, Module 9, Part 2, Creating a Security Plan, and all that goes with it. Okay, a couple of announcements. Internal enrollments are happening starting today. I'll send out an announcement to the mailing list. If you want to take a networking course and aren't, or if you want to take this class over because you are falling behind and you're going to need more time to catch up, you can do that. I believe it's going to be $75 if you want to continue on in this class and retake it. All of your labs and tests, yes, your tests actually will count for you this time and will all roll over, unlike last year where your exams all completely didn't roll over. So if you are struggling and falling behind and don't feel like you're going to finish by the end of January, let us know and we will move you into the next class and all will be right with the world. Any questions on internal enrollments? We're offering Discovery 1, Exploration 1, and 2 if you graduate Exploration 1, of course, and ITE1 next year.
When do they need to be done by?
That is on your cisco.netacad homepage, and it very clearly says the 31st of January.
No, it's the 31st of January, isn't it?
Sorry? What, the enrollments, you mean?
Oh, enrollments. Whenever you get around to it, you guys don't have to fill out any application forms or anything. You just have to send me a little message that says, hey, I want to be in this class.
And then the money when you need.
Yep, basically.
Yeah, I'm just sort of wondering when I need to decide by, because I'm needing to think about what to do next year and stuff.
Well,
we can talk to you.
We can talk to you individually. Luke, something different for you. I forgot. If you continue in ITE1, you have to go into the all New Zealand class taught by Kylie Maloney.
Fair enough.
And I'm not sure if she's going. I mean, I don't see why she wouldn't, but I don't know if she'll honor your labs. She'll have to honor your tests, but I'm not sure if she'll honor labs. She should. I don't know why she wouldn't.
She would, or she'd have to remark them. The rule is that if you're not going to honor the ones that are already submitted, you've got to remark the existing content. So hang on to those labs, and worst case scenario, she'll remark. Best case scenario, she'll honor them. So you won't lose out either way.
It would be a lot more work if she decided not to, that's for sure.
I don't see why she wouldn't.
Yeah, apparently there is going to be an all New Zealand thing going on next year, and we will tell everybody more about that when we know. So if you have anybody else in NZ who might be interested in the program, we can get them in touch with the facilitator over there.
Yeah, I can think of several. That's useful. I'll mention that to Kickstart next year.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Grace, are we going to be taking any holidays with regards to Christmas, New Year sort of period?
Oh, yeah. No, we'll quit. We'll have a holiday, and we'll talk about... We'll see where we are, and we'll talk about what we're going to do with the rest of our lectures when that time comes, and we'll pick dates, and it'll all be good.
I think what will probably happen and what generally happens is, and it depends on where we are in the lecture series, but we finish by December 18, usually, and then if there's a balance of lectures, Grace needs to decide what she wants to do with those balance of lectures, but we would hope that the lectures would
be
done.
They'd probably be in January.
Yeah, that'd be unusual. If we have to do that, we will. And if we do, there will be recordings up if you're out partying.
I'm thinking we're lecturing through January.
If you want me to go through January, I can do that, and that's fine. We can do review, we can do whatever you guys want to do, and that's all good. I'll just work from home, and that'll be fine.
Let's wind it up and party through Christmas.
Yep, sounds like a plan. We will be available over the holiday break, generally via email only, and we will jump on Skype at your request. Grace may be bouncing around Skype more than I will be, but I tend to be allergic to my work Skype between about the 18th of December and about January 20, so you'll actually have to ping me to get my attention if anybody wants to talk to me.
That makes sense.
Seriously, if you want us, you can get hold of us via email. I'll be on Skype because I'll be doing intake interviews anyway, so if you want me, I will be quite available.
And I don't know if you guys have noticed, but has the press release actually started going out? I think Blind Bargains has it now.
Blind Bargains got it first, and they put it up.
So if you know people who you think would want to know about the class, you could let them know, and they would probably be very happy to have more people enrolled.
Actually, what we'd really like people to do is for people to tell people about the course and explain to them that, no, this is not a sham and that you did it and it was good, and no, we're not trying to take your money and run. We do try and teach you things, because we have a lot of people who don't really believe that we're running. And you guys as previous students, this is either a terrible waking dream or you've been studying ITE1 and enjoying it for the past, you know, in months. So if you could let other people know that you feel who might be interested, we'd be more than happy to interview them and stuff.
Do you want any sighted students or not?
No, sighted
no,
students.
Sorry.
Nah, vision impaired.
We would love to take on sighted students, but unfortunately our special pricing model doesn't extend to that, and if we put sighted people in at the prices we charge you guys, the other academies will chase us down. So we're not going to do that. Sorry, somebody wanted to say something that we keep cutting off, and this will be the third time we've done it, so I'm going to let go of the key and you can say whatever it is.
Should we send people, I mean, I saw it several times on Twitter, should we send people, if they want the new application form for new people, to ciscovision.org?
You should send them to me. They need to email an inquiry out to me, if they can do that.
So it's caviinfo@gmail.com, right?
Yeah, it's caviinfo@gmail.com, and what we'll be doing is updating the application forms on Cisco Vision in the next week. They're not ready to fly yet, but what we're doing is we're taking expressions of interest to caviinfo@gmail.com, and they need to email I'm interested, and then Grace will shovel them out a doc pack if that's what they want to do. And no, we do not collect people's email addresses for any longer than we need to have them. That's another thing that we're very clear on.
Yeah, no, because I've actually had people who have sort of been at my house for lectures and stuff and expressed interest, and I've said, this is a very cool thing and you should do it. So I'll send some people.
Thank you.
Please do.
Even if they just want to talk to Grace and or you know us about what the courses are about, and you know, just because you email caviinfo@gmail.com doesn't mean you're committing, but we will need to know final enrolments by about January 20. So if they don't know whether they want to be in, they've got to decide by January 20. And if they don't, it's okay. We just go, thanks for calling. But if they do, we'd be more than happy to have them. So that's sort of the decision time deadline that we're putting on at this point, I believe.
I've spent hours on the phone with people, like one person, you know, talking to them about the program and answering all of their questions, and it's not a problem if they're really interested and really considering it. So, yeah. Okay, also, if you want to distribute to a list, please write to me and tell me or ask me, and I will give you permission just so we don't have any duplicates. That's the only reason.
We will forward you the materials that you need to distribute on that list, and some recommended text. But if you've got ideas of lists, please get in touch with us first, because we don't want six posts to blind whingers.
All right, I think that's that. Any questions, comments, concerns about labs? If you're having trouble with labs, let me know. Definitely contact me, and I will be happy to help you out. I've been walking people through a lot of labs and Skyping people up to explain things to them. This is not a problem. You just need to let me know. I had a conversation with someone via direct message today about their labs. It was quite an interesting way of doing it, and it worked very well, so we're very flexible and we'll communicate with you in the medium you choose. If you're having trouble with the lab, let us know right away so we can help you, and you're always welcome to move on to another lab if you're having trouble with one and come back to it. Any questions?
The other thing I was going to point out is a lot of people seem to be struggling with research and finding computer parts and all that sort of stuff. We do have a number of research skills lectures under the Thursday Chats area of our website. One of them is a Google Tips, which will even show you how to do temperature conversions, measurement conversions, and all sorts of other things with Google that I personally never knew you could do. And it also has some information on how to track down information and how to narrow things down and those sorts of things. So there may be some people who may find those sorts of resources useful. If anybody would like some of our content converted into DAISY, you need to tell us what content and what you'd like to see, and it might happen, but no guarantees, but we would certainly look at it and give it a go. I've got enough of the original audio to slice the thing into little bits and put it together in DAISY if that's something people really wanted. But be warned that if you want it converted into DAISY and you think you've got a way of doing it, we'll want a list of section headers and cue points, and then we'll make it happen for you. So it's not a thing to be undertaken lightly. The files will play on your regular talking book players without the DAISY markup, but if you want it sliced, we can do it.
All right. So last week I told you guys all about security threats and all of these horrible things that can happen to your data and your computers. I didn't tell you how to protect yourself against them, so that is what I'm going to do today. This is a really, really cut down version of how to make a security plan. We'll be revisiting this, quite luckily, in Chapter 16, because after what they've cut out of this chapter, God knows we'll need to. All right. Security plans are made before a crisis when people's heads are clear and calm. A security plan involves testing for weaknesses in your current setup, as well as implementing and reviewing policies as new threats emerge. So really important to make these plans before crisis happens, because you're going to be panicked when that data's gone and you're not really going to be able to act in the best of ways.
Okay, spot question. Without actually giving any information away, can we have a yeses for anybody who's been involved in a security incident? You do not have to give details. Your work's been hacked, you've been virused, anything like that. Anybody been involved in this?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah, me too. And yeah, okay, so this is important, guys. We're not just blowing smoke. This security stuff is really important, and we don't want you guys to have your identity thieved to realize how important it is, which is a horrible thing to have happen to anybody, and we know people that it has happened to, and they weren't our cousins, friends, uncles, you know, whatever. There were people we actually knew quite well. So this security plan and this stuff is really important for businesses and stuff, and a lot of the time this will differentiate you between you being a good IT technician and an okay IT technician. Okay, I'll throw it back to Grace.
I have a fantastic computer programming friend who got his identity stolen. And I was with him, and his credit card was declined at a gas station when we were on our way home. And, his identity got stolen, and he knows all about security. So, it's just, I didn't think it could happen to me type of thing. Well, it can. There are several questions you should ask when creating a security plan. What assets require protection? As in, what do we have? What data do we not want to lose? What computers do we not want to lose? A good question to actually ask is, what would business be like without this asset? And if there would be a problem in losing that asset, once you ask this question, you're going to need to find a way of protecting it. This goes for data, this goes for physical, basically any asset that would be a detriment to the company if it was lost, stolen, or distributed all over the internet. What are the possible threats? Well, see the rest of this chapter that we talked about last week, and you'll know all of the threats. What do we do in the event of a security breach? What logging is in place? How are we going to fix it? What happens if our company is infiltrated? Security is the responsibility of every person in the organization, from the CEO to the lowly toilet cleaner, especially them, because they have all the keys and access to the building. This is why it's important to clearly state the scope.
Hang on. No, there's an interesting point that I just want to stop there. They have a lot of keys, but there are maybe some keys that the janitor who waxes floors shouldn't have. And perhaps some of those keys are to the server room and the wiring closets.
Oh, absolutely. They have no business being in there. But a lot of organizations do give them keys in case there is, if they're like a building keeper, in case there was a fire or something really went wrong. Okay, you need to write your security plan your security policy in plain English, because everybody's got to be able to read it. You want to clearly state the scope of the policy, meaning yes, the thumb drives that you take home with full of company information are still under this policy, not just when you're in the building, and the consequences of someone failing to comply with it. Failing to comply might be bringing in a whole thumb drive full of your pictures and having a virus on that thumb drive. You shouldn't have brought your personal thumb drive into work.
Now, one of the things I was very quickly researching the other day, to keep this to 20 seconds or less, if you Google up disable auto run, there is a Microsoft article that shows you how to use the group policy editor or the registry editor to disable auto run on all thumb drives. Go and do it, unless you've got a specific reason not to. Why do you need auto run on your thumb drive, unless, of course, you're running one of those Ceratec or JAWS portable screen readers that you want to auto run? Auto run on thumb drives is one of the biggest ways that viruses bounce between computers, so if you don't need it, switch it off.
Okay. It's also important to educate people, even the people who do not use a computer in the organization, about the security policy. Now, why do you guys think it's important to educate people who aren't using computers about your security policy?
Because sometimes they can be just even more dangerous than the people that know how to do it. Unintentionally,
absolutely.
Usually, but sometimes they do things and they think, oh, well, this is a great idea.
They're also probably, they may be in charge of some of the physical security, like don't let strangers into the building, all of that kind of thing. Remember that the security doesn't only have to do with hands-on computer, but you've got your physical security for computers to deal with as well. Passwords are not are an important part of security.
If you saw Grace's machine, you'd think that they weren't, because hers just auto-locks it in.
No, it doesn't.
He
not
almost
anymore.
Broke.
Oh, that's right. I chucked a hissy and said I wasn't going to help you to do Tweak UI to do it. And if you wanted to do it, you have to go to Tweak UI and do it yourself. Yeah, auto logon is bad, okay?
User control passwords 2 is good.
Anybody played with user control passwords 2? Control. Isn't it control user 2? User passwords 2. Yeah, it's control user
it's
passwords 2.
It's something like that.
What, I've never even heard of it.
It's cool. It's like the way to get to a lot of the user account stuff without having to deal with the page has 3 links.
Oh, fair enough.
It's an alternate interface to the user manager, so I'll post the actual command on the list later, but you start run control user passwords 2, although I think passwords has a capital P or something odd, so I'll have to get the exact capitalization, and it gets you into sort of the gizzards of the user control stuff. The other thing you want to have a play with, but please, people, do this on a virtual machine. That's why we give you images, so that you don't ham your regular machine over. Start run, gpedit.msc is the group policy editor, and that lets you set all the system policies and stuff. And please, play with it on the virtual machine before you go and let it loose on your workstation.
And if users you have XP Home, you won't be able to do it anyway.
So you go and edit the registry instead, which is about what I was just about to say.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got our password guidelines, which need to be clearly outlined as well. Make sure that employees use strong passwords to keep data safe. A strong password is usually at least 8 characters, mixed case, that means upper and lower case, and includes symbols or numbers, or both. You may also force employees to change their passwords on a regular basis. Many companies do this every 60 or 90 days. So your password will expire, they'll be like, you need to put in a new password and confirm it, and there you go, you're now in.
Now, just the black side of that, this sort of policy will, of course, occasionally get your employees wanting to chase you down in dark alleys and finishing you off because they just spent 59 days remembering what their old password that looked slightly different from incomprehensible line noise was. Be careful that your users, if you put in too tight a password retention policy and a password change policy, make sure your users aren't writing their passwords down on bits of paper stuck underneath their desks.
Yep, that's coming up. Yeah, go ahead.
At my work, we have that good old 90-day rollover password policy to get into your computer, but then when you finally do log in, you've got to log into the call center program, another application. I've got various websites I'm registered to for their passwords as well. Has anybody got a great suggestion on how to manage all these passwords without finding it down?
Yep. KeePass.
It's spelled KEEPASS, and it's www.KEEPASS, so it's keepass.info, and it runs under Windows. There's a Linux version. It's relatively accessible with screen readers. There is one master password that locks all of the other ones, and it basically puts everything into a KDP file that you can stick on a thumb drive or move around the place. You can either scramble the database with a master password, a key file, a number of key files or a combination of a master password and a key file. But let me tell you, if you do it with key files and you lose the key files, you're not getting them back. They really do a good job of making sure that you can't get the password back to that one. So be warned. But keepass.info, and it's a password manager, and it's even got plugins for your browser so that when it sees you log on to a specific website, it will feed the passwords into the form for you. So that's kind of flash.
That's what I want. Thank you.
I think you've just made her very...
Yay! Yes, okay,
yes.
You should... Cool. Okay, you should also lock accounts out when incorrect password is typed in a number of times. This is usually 3 or 5. So if somebody's typed in the password a certain number of times, it's going to lock them out. Okay.
My friend was telling me that at his school, they had a bunch of Macs, and if you... typed your password in wrong 3 times or however, when it locked out, whatever software they used the Mac's camera and took a picture of the person logging on and sent an alert to the to their
IT
people.
There are lots of programs that actually do that.
Which is kind of sneaky and cool.
What was that stuff for the PC that was supposed to monitor everything and tell you where your computer was and use your webcam to take pictures and stuff? I remember tweeting about it about 200 days ago, but I can't remember what it was called.
Oh, no.
And basically what it would do is it ran sort of hidden in the background and stuff. And if somebody logged onto your computer and you didn't want them to, or your computer went missing, you could click on this thing on a website that would activate the where is my computer thing. And then if your computer logged on and connected from anywhere and people didn't know that this stuff was running in the background, which is completely free software, it would then take snapshots of the user, it would give you a latitude and longitude of your computer, and all sorts of stuff so that you could find out where it went. So I think I'll be wanting to look that up, because otherwise some of the students here will come and track me down, because it was really quite useful software. And it would let you find your computer and perhaps track it down, a bit like, you know, Mobile Me or Where Is My iPhone, Find My iPhone, and stuff like that. So, interesting technology.
Does that work only in America, or does it work in other
worldwide.
Oh, okay.
It will work wherever you are. However, if you don't have location technology on your computer, the GPS will only be accurate down to the publicly accessible IP address of the wireless access point that you are connected through.
Most computers these days have GPSs in them?
No.
But most modern mobile phones do, and most iPhones certainly do. iPod touches don't, but a lot of the stuff falls back to geolocation based on the IP address, which is...
Which can be good.
It's very accurate sometimes, yeah.
Okay.
And if anybody knows any sites, and I'll be doing a Google After lecture that will let you find out where it thinks your IP address is located, I think there are some. I'm going to go and have a look and see how accurate it is, because the lats and longs for our place were pretty bang on from what I can remember from the geolocation stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So when you get locked out, the employee will have to either wait a period of time, 15 minutes, an hour, or they'll have to call the help desk and say, please reset my password, I screwed up. And you'll get to reset their password because they screwed up. You also need to decide who has access to what data, as in data secure, or data access levels is what they call it. Let's take an example of a school and all of its data and departments. The first category of data is going to be public data. This is the first classification. It is the data that students, staff, and the public can access. Examples of this data are school closures, special events, and what badness is on special at the cafeteria. The next level up is information for students, teachers, and staff. The public does not need to see this. This is stuff such as course notes, worksheets, and things like that. Access to your tests, whatever it is, that's up on a website. Students and staff will need to see this, but the public really doesn't need to, and if they did, it would be copyright infringement. So we'll keep that secured. The next level might be the teacher's information. This could be confidential information such as grades and student progress reports. The students might need to see theirs, but they're not going to want to see it. Well, they might want to see everybody else's, but they really shouldn't, because lawsuits would happen. You might also have different classifications for different departments of staff. let's say that we've got a financial aid department, and they might need to, or they will definitely need to, access transactions of what students have paid and which classes they've paid for and whether students are paid up. Now, the teachers won't need to access this information. In parallel, the staff of the financial aid department don't need to access the study materials. Does that make any sense, the data classifications there, guys?
So was there four classifications or three?
There were three sort of classifications. It doesn't really matter because it's just an example. It's not something
sure,
you'll be tested on.
One.
Yeah. It's not really... it's just that there are data classifications. This is great. Yeah, this is... That's just an analogy.
One other thing, this is a handy social engineering tip. When you are designing a security system, do not give users access to stuff and then take it away from them unless you want them to be very annoyed with you. So if you're going to design the system, design it and lock it down and then open access to things as they're required, because that will make a lot of people get very angry if they sort of had access to stuff and then you pull it away from them and then you've got to go and explain to them why you chopped them out of different things. So that's just something to be careful of.
We have that with the internet at work. Some people get it and some people don't. And when they move, if you take it away, they get really angry.
Fair enough. Yeah, the classifications are just basically that there are classifications. You can classify data from public all the way up to top secret. Not that you really would call them those classifications. Not that you probably even really name the classifications, but there you have it. It's ensuring that people get access to the data they need to do their job, but don't get access to confidential data that they don't need to see, is basically it. Okay, we will talk about physical security. It is just as important to protect your physical equipment as your data. Here are some things you can do to protect your physical equipment. Control access to facilities, and there are several ways of doing this, including card keys that store user data, including level of access. We actually, when I was at NASA, had these, and you swiped your card key, and if you had access to that floor, the door would open. If you didn't, well, nothing would happen.
Boxcar and stuff is going do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do every time somebody messages Grace, so we're just getting the iPod turned off.
Shut up. All right, there we go.
Our apartment building does that with the keypad thing, actually, and it's very interesting because there's two buildings in our complex. Like, they're on the same street and everything. They're right next to each other. They're actually connected. But one building only has sort of security at the front door, and then once you're in the front door, you can get into, you know, any floor of the building. But our building, you've got to swipe your card again to get onto whatever floor you want. And so my keys will only work on the fourth floor, which I think is quite cool.
That is really cool. And totally funny, because funnily enough, that was the floor that I had access to at NASA. So, okay, we have biometric sensors that identify physical characteristics of users, such as fingerprints or retinas. We will come back to those in a little bit.
Mythbusters, anyone?
We were going to talk about that in a little bit.
Jolly good.
Now that it's ruined. Posted security guards and sensors such as RFID tags. You can use cable locks with equipment that tie the equipment down. Keep telecommunications rooms locked. This is kind of a no-brainer, but you'd be surprised how many people don't. Fit equipment with security screws. Screw the computers down to something. Use security cages around equipment, such as networking equipment. Label and install sensors, such as radio frequency identification, RFID tags, on equipment. Install physical alarms triggered by motion detection sensors. And use webcams with motion detection and surveillance software.
Question. Has anybody on here had anything to do with smart card technology for PCs for doing logins and stuff? Anybody messed with that?
I used to, at the bank, we had one of these things that randomly generated a six-digit PIN, and I used to have to read it with the opticon and be really quick about it because it changed every minute.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
So what did they do for blind people who did not have an opticon?
You probably didn't work in the bank.
No, it's not the bank. No. It's actually something they did for users.
I don't know, because, I mean, there were a few other people, and, like, the one lady had her husband read it to her, and that's what they suggested when I first got one. They said, well, don't you have a family member at home to read it? I said, no. And I thought, well, I'll try it with the Opticon. It actually worked, which really surprised me, because it was an LCD. I don't know what they do.
I think I'd be banking with a different bank.
Yeah, but weren't you working for them rather than just banking with them?
Yeah, no, this was to get into the VPNs. This wasn't for, you know, being customers.
Fair enough, because there are some in America that they do that for being a customer, and it's like, no.
I'm amazed at how many people think that you've got this sighted person at home that reads things to you. Look, if anybody can tell me, if there are some cheap ones on eBay that I can buy, can you let me know? Because a couple of them would come in handy. Grace and I don't seem to have one. And I am saying that tongue-in-cheek. But, yeah, all these people, you sort of, you know, Grace goes walking to the chemist, and the woman goes, don't you have somebody to look after you? And we're like, yeah, we wish.
Are you volunteering, lady?
I've got a fantastic 10-year-old, and she actually, if I could clone her, I'd be very, very rich. But, yeah, I'm quite happy to put her on eBay, perhaps, to the highest bidder.
Oh, okay, no. Yeah, no, that...
Yeah, no, I've had that.
I'm not people have said,
you know, people have said that my 3-year-old, that was his job. He's there to sort of read things for Mom and Dad. Maybe I missed something.
Not yet.
Right.
I think the only scarier thing I saw was a 5-year-old who actually could read things, and she did. She used to read things for her father and call taxis and all sorts of things. Scary stuff. But anyway, back to our lecture thing. But no, we don't all have sighted people to look after us. So you know, it's all good.
I think we're preaching to the choir here.
We are, but it was an interesting point regarding the numbers on screens and and those sorts of things that, you know, there aren't always workarounds to.
Speaking of that, what is an Opticon, and what are RFID tags, and how do they work?
Okay, an Opticon is a very old piece of technology, which you really can't get anymore, that I want, that allows you to feel vibrations with your finger to read printed letters.
And it took a lot of training.
That would be weird.
I would so love one. I think I'd be quite good.
And they sort of go, and they vibrate, and they're really bizarre. And when you first see one, you're just like, what is this bizarre thing? And the little pins pop up and vibrate and stuff. And as you say, once you get used to it, it's great.
Yeah, you sort of put the array on the first knuckle of your index finger, like where that joint would be. And I need to try and get a look at one. I think I know somebody who's got one.
Yeah. RFID tags are radio frequency identification tags, and they basically transmit a radio frequency, and you have an RFID scanner, and you run it across, and it tells you what that item is.
Similar to some of the proximity sensors for things like multi-rider swipe-on, swipe-off cards, some of those use RFID technology. It's basically a proximity thing. You get close enough to the reader and the reader can pick up what it is. A lot of you would have seen similar technology on anti-theft tags in stores, which are really fun to put in the microwave. But if it blows your microwave up, don't blame me. The anti-theft tags sort of blow up with lots of sparks. But yeah, we don't recommend any of our students do that.
I wonder if that's kind of like my pay pass that, like, at the top of the pin pad, they have this pad, and then I put my card on them, and then it goes beep, and it goes...
Yeah, that's similar, I believe. We've got the similar system for a building here. I'm not sure which ones are actually defined as RFID and which ones are actually contact sensor and what sort of underlying technology they use, but that's the sort of thing we're talking about.
Okay, you could also use hardware security built into the actual computer. One form of hardware security is Trusted Platform Model, or Module, sorry, TPM. The TPM is a specialized chip installed on the motherboard used for hardware and software authentication. The TPM stores information specific to the computer, such as encryption keys, digital certificates, and passwords.
I've actually seen these, and some machines have them, and they're this little encryption-decryption helpy chip. And yes, there are Linux drivers for the TPM as well. A lot of the ThinkPads have them, if anybody has seen them on the ThinkPads.
Our applications can use TPM chips to secure things like user authentication information, software license protection, and encrypted files, folders, and whole drives or disks. Integrating hardware security, such as your TPM, along with using security software, results in a much safer computer system rather than just using software security. Okay, next we'll talk about data security. Any questions on physical security? I'm thinking that covers it pretty well.
Just one comment.
So cool.
Go for it.
Yeah, we recently built a new building, and all of the security to get in and out of that building is all done with fingerprints.
They've probably improved the technology over the last couple of years, but when Mythbusters did some tests on fingerprint sensors, they were able to fool them with models of the fingers and plasticine models and all sorts of things. So I'm sure the technology's gotten better, but it was pretty astonishing as to what things would actually fool a fingerprint sensor.
Okay, next we're going to talk about data security. Losing data can actually be more expensive and detrimental than actually having equipment stolen. The loss or leak of data to companies, competitors, or to criminals can be costly, money-wise, and in terms of companies' reputation. Unfortunately, when these things happen, people want a scapegoat, someone to blame for the incidents, and the technician in charge is usually it. Failing to secure data can cost you your job and reputation as a technician, so it's very important to know how to do this. There are several things you can do to protect your organization against data loss. The first and most obvious is passwords, and we've discussed this earlier. All computers and capable networks devices should have passwords. We've got two levels of password protection that are recommended. If you can, you may want to do a BIOS password that prevents the operating system from booting and prevents BIOS settings from being changed without the appropriate password. I'd say probably not so important to have the BIOS password for the operating system to boot, but definitely have a supervisor password for the BIOS to be changed.
Just be warned, though, that not only are there lists of default BIOS passwords that actually override the password you put in, the manufacturer's backdoor passwords, but there is also the case that on a whole lot of boards that holding down Control, Alt, and Insert while you power the machine up will clear the CMOS, taking the password with it. So be aware that your particular model of machine may have backdoors through its BIOS password that you should be aware of.
There's no real way to block those?
No, and you probably wouldn't really want to, because if you did and somehow something happened to your password, you forgot it, or it got corrupted, God help you.
Now, there's another thing that they don't talk about here, or do they? Do they mention hard disk passwords?
Nope.
Oh, watch out with this one. There is the possibility of setting a password on your hard disk. Okay, and you can actually put in a string, and then the drive will put that into its firmware, and then it will scramble the entire contents of the drive with that password. Okay, if you forget that password, the way you get your drive back is a security erase. Guess how much data is left on your drive once that's done, boys and girls?
Yeah.
But most drives do support this password feature, and if you are concerned about your hard drive, inside your netbook BIOS or your laptop BIOS, there is the ability to put the password on the hard drive. And if you do that, it means that if the laptop is stolen and somebody doesn't put the password in, they can't get your data back. So it's worth knowing about. The other one I was just going to quickly flag, and we won't talk about it, TrueCrypt, TRU.
That's what I was going to say. True. If you're that paranoid about it, use TrueCrypt, more accessible.
No. That just goes beep when you boot up and you key the password in. And if you don't put the right password in, it goes beep, and you put the password in again. That's how the hard disk password works at boot up. But TrueCrypt will let you encrypt a subset of your data. It'll let you do flash drives. It will let you do encrypted volumes. And you can go and look that up. It's a piece of freeware. Just be careful, because if these are very strong encryptions, if you don't have the passphrases and stuff, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. Another problem we had with people installing Vista specifically, and I've seen it about 5 times, they didn't realize they had their caps lock on when they keyed in the initial usernames and passwords. And then when the system came up and they tried to log in, it wouldn't let them, and they panicked because they swore they knew what the password was. And we said, right, we'll toggle the caps lock and then see if it works. And they're like, oh, I thought I was going to have to reinstall again. So that's another one to watch out for. Even though there's a balloon that warns you that caps lock's on, a lot of people don't notice it.
All right, the next type of password is login password. This prevents unauthorized access to local computers and the network. Network logins provide a means of logging activity on the network and either preventing or allowing access to resources. This makes it possible to determine which resources are being accessed. Usually the system administrator defines a naming convention for usernames when creating a network login. A common example of a username is the first initial of the person's first name and then the second, and then the entire last name. You can get some really interesting usernames by doing this. There's probably an email floating around the internet with these interesting usernames and email addresses that you can get by using this naming convention that you guys can look up and have a laugh at some point. I've seen it floating around, so you should be able to find it. You need to keep the
username.
Yes.
I saw an email address that came in at work yesterday, and it actually read, "I eat my breakfast with a fork at hotmail.com."
Okay.
I have one to beat that. There was an old bloke on the train that my friend met that had an email address of "I paid my bill at telstra.com."
Oh no.
Okay. You need to keep these simple so that people do not have a hard time remembering their usernames. Usernames, like passwords, are an important piece of information and should not be revealed. Default usernames on a device such as routers should be changed so that hackers do not know either part of the username and password combination.
Ah, now here's an interesting point that I can probably bring up now. Anybody here played with BellArc Advisor?
Yep.
Many times.
Ah.
Okay, BellArc Advisor is this really cool piece of software that you can use for non-commercial use that will give you all sorts of information on which service packs and stuff you've applied to your system, and it pops it up on a web page so you can read it. I don't know whether anybody's actually paid any attention to the security score, which usually on most people's computers I've ever seen hovers around 0.3. If you actually click on the links and actually look up the things that you can actually set to improve that security score, there is also sorts of things where you can actually stop Windows from remembering the previous username. Because you know how usually when the login dialog box pops up, there's somebody else's username in there? Yeah, turning that off helps, okay, so that you don't see the previous username in the logon box. Means you've got to type it again, but, well, it's a tough world out there.
Mine kept saying unknown for some reason. On this
I've got a question.
Score.
Go ahead.
I had to reload my computer a couple of weeks ago. How do you spell BellArc again so I can get back on it?
BellArc.
Another thing, if you're unsure of how to spell a computer program, if you do your best, Google will probably correct you.
Did you mean blank?
Or actually, now it doesn't even do that. It just brings up the page and says, we think you meant this.
If you actually, for screen reader users, I'd turn off auto-suggest in your Google options because it's a pain. I tried to search for LLGAL this morning, which is a thumbnail generator for image files, and it pulled me up a page of legal stuff. It's like, no, Google, I actually wanted the program called LLGAL. So I actually had to go in and go, no, do not auto-suggest for me. And then it gave me the pages with LLGAL, which is what I was looking for.
I love this thing, but yeah, I haven't really seen it cause any problems. I just usually
I've never had an actual problem with it. I just ignore it.
There is actually one. I can't remember what the technology is actually called, but it actually refreshes the page as you type a lot.
Google Instant.
Yeah, that's you want
to
kill that.
That needs to go.
Well, until Jaws 13 comes out and supports Google Instant ARIA 3.7 or whatever.
It doesn't seem to cause any problems for me, but I probably should teach people to turn it off. So.
It's never caused me a problem.
Google Instant is different from the auto suggestions, so have a look at both, because I actually have had one where you couldn't actually click the search button, because once you type things into the edit field, it went pop, 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 but it wouldn't actually complete the search even if you dacked the search button when Google Instant was on, so I don't know, maybe it was my setup, but it was pretty weird. And in fact, Google has a link that says, screen reader users, click here to turn off Google Instant. So I did.
Well, when I saw that, I was kind of like, well, do we really need to, or is it they think we need to?
Yeah, I've never had a problem.
Now watch, you'll have one today.
Yep, and then I can tell you all that I had a problem.
That'll be the way.
Okay, totally, now that I've said it. Go ahead.
The other thing with routers and stuff, that's really important, because like motherboards, it's very easy to find default usernames and passwords for almost every imaginable router and device out there.
Oh, yeah.
On the internet, oh, yeah. Without trying hard.
I would imagine port forward would have those.
It does.
Yeah, and that's by design, so that you can help your poor aging mother figure out how to get into her router without the user manual.
My poor aging mother should not be logging into the router unless I'm on the phone to her, with a subnote that I'm aging as well, okay? So we're not picking on the poor aging mothers here. Yeah, default usernames and passwords are everywhere on the internet. There's actually canonical lists of them. And if you haven't changed your router's default password, you know, after this lecture, I'd be making yourself a beverage and going and doing that if you can figure out how to do it, and keep the password in a safe spot. Perhaps you could store it in your KeepS program.
Yep. Encourage your employees. Actually, make sure your employees do not write their password down so that they cannot expose it to others. Probably not even in their diary, because you're going to open that diary and somebody might see it. So don't write it down. Commit it to memory. Keep it in KeepS, whatever you're going to do. But don't write it on a piece of paper, please. Security risk.
Or cell phone.
Just got... possibly. That's safer than a piece of paper.
If your phone gets stolen, not really.
Yeah,
there is There are password applications in the mobile phone that can protect your passwords. There is usually a password app. I think there are various ones you can get for the iThing that will store all your passwords and stuff.
Tons.
Yeah, but are any of them accessible?
I'm not sure. Another thing you have going for you, if you're blind and you read Braille, is Braille, especially if you're not working in a blindness organization or you have a note taker.
Hey, I'm the only blind person where I work, so I put mine on... on the label tape, you know, the 3M labeler, underneath the desk.
That'll do ya. This is one place where Braille comes in really handy. Use it, guys.
However, be aware, and as it is interesting that there are Braille alphabets on Wikipedia, so just be aware of that. And make sure that if you do put it on Braille, that you put it somewhere fairly hidden, because there are people who are smart enough to Google up Braille fonts and then match it against what you wrote on the tape and get your password back. So it's security is relative.
Can do that.
Yeah, I don't put what the password's for, though.
No, you just stick it somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. The other thing to do it is, if you've got the ability to do it on something... something like, if you've got Interpoint, that's really nasty. Some of people hate that. Or Braille displays and stuff are harder, because it's harder for them to get in and get those passwords out.
Because usually they're not going to know how to go into your note taker, open the file you need that has it
in
it.
Yeah, good luck, guys. Yeah. Go ahead, Curtis.
Another thing you could do is there's a program called KeePass. It's a password database, and you can put all your passwords and stuff in there.
We've been talking about it.
I was on a call, sorry.
Okay. Oh, fair enough.
Not to worry. We've covered KeePass quite extensively, but thank you for bringing that one up. So there you go. See, even Curtis likes KeePass, everyone. So if you haven't got out and got KeePass, it is a piece of free software.
Take it from Curtis.
Yeah, get KeePass. It rocks.
Okay, to simplify the process of administrating security... That is a weird sentence. It is common to assign users to groups and then to assign groups to resources. This allows the access to access capability of users on network to be changed easily.
Ooh.
By assigning or what?
Yeah, by assigning resources to users or groups. Can anybody tell me what is the difference between a local group and a global group? Does anyone know?
Local might be like human resources. Local might be like a human resources group, and global is like all around the company, or, you know, kind of like world, you know, a bigger group.
No, a local group is only relevant to the workstation that you are running on. A global group is network-wide. So you assign local users and local resources to local groups, and you assign network resources to global groups. That's not in our chapter, but if you ever do anything with Windows networking, you will need to know this.
Yeah, that's actually beyond the scope of this, but always good to know. So what you do with groups is, if you've got a user that is moving to a different department in the company, you just take that user, take them out of the one group that they're in, put them in another group, and there you go. The permissions are all set and all changed, and it doesn't take you very much time to do this. This is really good for visiting workers or consultants. because you can limit access to resources.
If you're serious about your sharing security, and I haven't met many people who have been, you can actually create little groups on your workstation and say the parents are one group and the children are the other group, and then you can give the parents access to a set of subfolders and the children access to another set of subfolders, and that way you can have you can still have your usernames and passwords, but then you can actually give different level sharing access to the people that are going to connect to your shared resources on your home network.
Security retentive much?
That could be cool.
The next method of protecting data is data encryption, and this is really covered so extensively by this chapter, guys. Encrypting data uses codes and ciphers. Traffic between resources and computers on the network can be protected from attackers monitoring or recording transactions by implementing encryption. Even though the attacker may have the data, they may not be able to decrypt it in a timely fashion or at all, so it will be of very little use to them, possibly. A VPN connection uses this method to protect data and allows a remote user to safely access resources as if they were physically connected to the local network. You know what? That's all we've got on encryption, guys. They took most of the rest of it out.
Wow.
It's all gone.
So if you want to know about cryptography, there's actually some good cryptography books in Bookshare. Do they have Applied Cryptography by Bruce Schneier? I'll have to go and look later.
Does anyone have a Bookshare account and want to look?
Yeah, I can look.
Okay, cool.
Applied Cryptography is the book title. I'd be curious to know whether they've got a good book on encryption. And it actually makes sense to a lot of people, at least chapters 1 and 2 do, and then chapter 3 will turn your head inside out. But the first couple of chapters are kind of cool.
You still have a lot more on that. Maybe they put it in 16, but that's all you get. So, the next method of data protection we will talk about is software firewall.
They pulled all of the public key stuff out as well. Okay.
It's gone. Bye.
Okay, cool.
And hardware firewalls are not in this chapter either. So, as I said, a very basic overview of how to make a security policy. Data being transported on a network is called traffic. A software firewall is a program that runs on a computer to allow or deny traffic between computers and networks to which it is connected. As we discussed in Chapter 8, each service that uses TCP/IP is associated with a particular port. Now, don't be afraid to say anything if you do want this done. Does anyone need a review of what ports do what?
Yes.
All right.
Why not?
All right, so what we're going to do is what we did last time, and I'm going to give you guys... Actually, we're going to do the reverse. I'm going to give you guys a port and say answer now, and you all get to write into chat what port you think it is. And
hang on, that was ambiguous. Are you going to give them the name of the protocol, or you give them a port number?
Nope, I'm going to give them the port number because we did name a protocol last time.
Okay, that's fine. So you're going to get a port number, and then you're going to type in the name of what you think it is. I was confused. She's like, I'll give you a port, and then you'll tell me what the port does. And I'm like, so what information are we getting?
All right. So let's start with port 80. All right, answer now. Email's the closest. Email is the closest. 25, I said. Or did I say 80? I did say 80.
You said 80.
Sorry.
No, said
yeah. 80. Okay.
Drink more coffee.
Yeah, I'm awake today, okay. HTTP is absolutely...
Right, after this lecture, I'm giving you digital coffee from the Quantum Mind Power thing, I tell you. Okay, so if you said web or HTTP, you're correct.
Yeah, HTTP, you're all right. All right, so let's try another one. How about 443?
You can answer now.
Yeah, go ahead. So the two people who said HTTPS are absolutely right. 443 is HTTPS. How about port 25?
Answer now.
For those people who said SMTP, you're right. Email is not good enough for the test. You're going to have to actually tell which email protocol it is.
The reason being, very briefly, is that SMTP is generally used for the sending of email as far as a workstation is concerned, and IMAP/POP is used for the receiving of email on a workstation. Email servers do use SMTP for both sending and receiving, but generally speaking, at this point in your IT life, you're probably not messing with mail servers unless you're Brian. And maybe, I don't know, anybody else here mess with mail service? You can type yes or no. You type yes into chat if you do, because we don't need to hold everybody up.
Okay. So, we'll do a couple more. How about port 110?
Anyone else can answer now.
Anyone else? Pop 3 is right. How about port 21?
You were out by one, Luke. 22 is SSH.
Yep, 21 is FTP.
It's actually the FTP control port, just to be really specific.
Oh, bugger.
Nobody cares. If for this course, you don't. FTP is good enough. In Discovery, you're going to actually need to know that it's the control port. And one more. How about 143? IMAP is absolutely right. Good job, guys. There are a few more on that table that you can look up, but that's a general overview of your ports. And very good job with that. And we'll move on now.
Is there one question in the test on those? I think there is.
Oh, there's a couple, and you get a couple on your final.
Okay, so...
So this is something you guys really want to know. That's why I went over it again. If you were having trouble with that, don't feel bad. Just go study it some more. All right, a software firewall protects systems from intrusion by blocking or allowing data through these ports. You can choose what data can be sent by and to your computer by choosing which ports are open and which are blocked. You may need to create exceptions for certain applications to send and receive information. These tell firewalls that certain ports need to be open to TCP, UDP, or both types of traffic. One example of this is Skype. If you want to see what a phenomenal difference having a port open and putting an exception into a firewall will make, turn off your Windows firewall, which you can do because you're behind a router, right? Right. And put an exception of a port for Skype into your firewall.
We can stop here for a second. If your router supports universal plug and play, just ignore what she just said because Skype will do it for you now, ever since version 4. If your router is universal plug and play capable and universal plug and play is on, Skype will forward its own ports for you. It's just on Kerry's network where we don't run universal plug and play that doesn't work. If you don't run universal plug and play, yes, go and put the exception in for Skype. Sorry, continue.
I think that implementation on my router is a little bit scary, so I don't know whether it would actually be working. How can I tell if it's actually working?
Your Skype will log in really fast.
There is an easier way. You can actually run a netstat command, and if you have a direct connection from you to the person that you're Skyping in your netstat output, then your port forward is functioning.
Okay.
But you'll find an unbelievable increase in speed of logging in Skype and connecting calls and a bit more stability.
So if ever you wondered why Grace's iPhone doesn't work too well on Skype, it's because it doesn't have a port forwarded for it yet, so that's why it's a bit flaky. The other thing is, if you're in the middle of a call and supernodes disappear while you're in the middle of a call, that can often result in call drops and stuff on Skype. So if you can get this port forwarding stuff working, not only does it allow file transfers to run at full speed of your link, but it also allows much cleaner voice traffic to go straight through. So while Skype can punch its way through firewalls, which it usually does quite nicely, forwarding ports helps it out a lot.
And we all knew that Windows has its own built-in firewall, which you get to play with in Module 16. Woo-hoo.
Now, just a quick poll here. Has anybody pulled down the virtual machines for ITE1? Has anybody been playing with the virtual machines? Meredith, you don't have to answer this question because I helped you set them up a few weeks ago. Anybody else got the virtual machines down?
I got one.
Yeah, I have one.
Yep, that's all you'll need is the one.
You just need one of them. Does anybody, we won't go into it in big detail, we'll do it some other time, but a virtual machine is a pretend machine that you can mess around on without bricking your regular desktop. So if you're scared about breaking your laptop or desktop, you might want to look into the virtual machine stuff and get the little virtual Windows XP working and play with it so that you don't break your computer.
You do need a key for JAWS for that to work, don't you?
NVDA is already on it.
NVDA is on there. If you install any copies of JAWS onto the virtual machine, the licensing is your responsibility. Dongles will function. If you want to license JAWS on the virtual machine, it will eat one of your activation counts. I wouldn't recommend it. What I would recommend is running JAWS in demo mode and rebooting every 40 minutes. It's slightly inconvenient, but on a virtual machine, the reboot doesn't take that long, and it'll save you blowing one of your activation counts.
Okay.
However, we do ship with NVDA 2010.2 on our virtual machines by default, and any other screen technology such as Window Eyes or similar that you may legally own that doesn't require activation, you could certainly load Window Eyes or System Access, or you could use System Access to Go on your virtual machine. That's another option.
Actually, I think I need to update the NVDA. I think it's 10.1. So.
Let the users do it. We'll
For next semester, it'll be updated. You guys get to use the old one.
You can update it yourselves. So you gotta go.
Basically, because you're all competent and good at this.
And if you're not, then ask us for help. NVDA 2010.1 to NVDA 2010.2 on the virtual machine image if you're using NVDA on the image. You might want to update to 2010.2.
You've done this on your regular machine when we were doing your video drivers,
now,
so it's easy.
Yeah, the other thing that I
didn't hear what was said because when you were saying that, Grace, I was having lags with Kerry, so it was being fun.
Oh, fair enough.
The other thing I'll just point out is if you are partially sighted, you may want to actually have a play with NVDA because if you go into the mouse options, there's a talk text the mouse goes over and you can do the draggy, talky, clicky thing, which lots of low vision people love doing. What does that say? Drag. Desktop. Oh, that's what it says. So have a play with NVDA, especially because it doesn't require administrator privileges and will run off thumb drives. It rocks, and you do get used to the voice eventually.
It will run off thumb drives when it wants to.
No,
it does.
It usually will.
If yours isn't working, there's either a problem with your computer security policy or a problem with the way it's laid out on the thumb drive. It doesn't auto-launch unless you make it, but yes, it will run off thumb drives. And any problem with it not running off thumb drives is something to do with your environment.
Okay, another common sense security measure is data backups. They emasculated this section too. Data can be lost by theft, tampering, accidental deletion, data corruption, or disaster such as fire or flood. Here are some things you may want to define in your security plan regarding data backups. Frequency of backups. Backups can take a long time. Sometimes it's easier to make a full backup monthly or weekly, and then do frequent partial backups of any data that has changed since the last full backup. However, spreading the backup over many recordings increases the amount of time needed to restore the data. Storage of backups. Backups should be transported to an approved site for storage for extra security, so somewhere that is not at the company's site. The current backup media is transported to the off-site location on a daily, weekly, or monthly rotation as required by the local organization. Security of backups. Backups can be protected with passwords. These passwords would have to be entered before the data on the backup media could be restored. Yeah, seriously, that's it. Nothing about incremental backups or differential backups. Nothing there. So that's all you have to know for that for this chapter.
They missed a major critical point that almost cost me a job. Fortunately, I managed to fix it. Test your backup. It's slightest bit of damn good if it doesn't work when you need to restore something from it.
They did too.
Yeah, that's really important.
A bit of this is in 16, because I remember when I was reading it
before there's
I took
a lot of
the 16 exam again, a lot of this is in 16. They just kind of yoinked it out of here.
Thanks, guys.
The other thing to keep in mind is that, and this goes for everybody, when you're looking at backups and stuff, a lot of people buy an external hard drive and they back up all their data onto the external hard drive. Is it worth pointing out that most external hard drives fail within 6 to 8 months of purchase? Hey, are you sleeping better at night? Better buy a second one. Also, if you are going to back up to your external hard drive, make sure that you, as Brian said, check that your backups are going to function, and don't knock the drive off the desk, because that usually does a number on your backups as well. Quite a big number.
The more important the backup, the more easily it'll break.
That's one of the reasons I like a desktop drive, is because as long as you're very sure where it is, you're not is likely to knock it over, whereas those little passport drives, I could see those just go flying.
Oh, yeah.
Just a suggestion, and it may not have occurred to anybody, but BlueTack. If you BlueTack your hard drive down, it's not going to fall off the desk as easily. It's cheap, it's inexpensive, and it means you're not going to swipe it. Also, run your cables sensibly. And seriously, removable drives are cheap enough for you to own a couple of them. They can fail, and it only takes one good knock to finish them off. And I actually saw a guy that would sort of walk in and go, "I'm in." The backpack would go onto the floor, and I'd go, "Excuse me, John, we'll just call him John, isn't that the backpack with your 120 gig drive in it?" "Oh, yeah, I suppose it is." To you know, 10 minutes later, "My 120 gig drive isn't working." Screwdriver, and the dropping of the backpack had caused the drive to slide out of the connector in the circuit board, and it was no longer making contact inside the case, so we had to unscrew the case, remount the drive, and put it back in, and then instruct John not to dump his backpack
really
on the floor.
And he's really lucky that that's all it was.
Yes, he is. I have a suggestion if you are very hard on drives, and this drive is a little bigger, but it will help. It is a C case, and it has a special type of case on it. It's got rubber bumpers on it, and you could probably drop this thing off a building. Not that I'd recommend it, and it would probably be safe. It's a very rugged drive, and they come in 500 gig and probably bigger. They're very good, and they're actually not too expensive.
Toughbooks are also supposed to be very good, but they're difficult to get here.
I think dropping it off a building would be a bit much, because the actual jolt of it landing would probably kill it. It's designed for small levels of shock, not the sort of shock that happens from dropping it from large distances. So it's a balance between, you know, rubber baby buggy bumpers and you know, reliability of the drives. But yeah, the Lassies are a good drive, and you can get ruggedized cases. Also, if you do have a removable hard drive, you can often buy some cheap padded bags for about $5 or $10 off eBay or cheapstuffonline.com, and you can then put your drive in that, and that will also provide a certain amount of protection. We got some; they're quite good.
Catch of the Day often has them, Karen.
yeah. If you're not in Australia, that won't help you.
There's also Catch of the Day New Zealand, but
is there?
Oh, that's
yes,
cool.
There is
got one.
Yep.
Grace, is that C case?
No. Catch of the Day.
Catch of the Day. .com.a.
As in CATCH. Oh, what's CK, sorry?
The name of the actual hard drive she's talking about was a CK.
Oh,
Lassie.
Lassie. L-A-C. How do you spell Lassie? I-E. Anybody?
I-E.
L-A-C-I. I think I've heard some people say Lassie as if it's like two words. The Mac says Lacey, but you'll know it when you see.
Thank you.
No problem. Okay, smart card security. We were actually just talking about this. These can be the same cards used to gain physical access to a building. A smart card is a small plastic card about the size of a credit card with a small chip embedded in it. The chip is an intelligent data carrier capable of processing, storing, and safeguarding thousands of bytes of data. Smart cards store private information such as bank account numbers, personal identification, medical records, and digital signatures. Smart cards provide authentication and encryption to keep data safe. Biometrics can also be used to access data. The theory is that it should be more secure than discoverable passwords or stealable smart cards, but we talked about that, and it might not be.
The other thing, if anybody's seen the movie Angels and Demons, there are probably problems with biometric security, especially where they gouge the guy's eye out so that they can use it to scan it through the biometric sensors when they nick the container of antimatter. Now, I realise that's fictional, but people have had fingers and stuff chopped off so that you could get through the biometric security.
Fantastic movie, by the way.
There is actually a weird issue. I had a weird issue. I applied for one of these Nexus cards that's sort of a pre-cleared U.S. travel card because I do it a lot. And one of its security measures is a retinal scan. Well, I have ROP, so my retinas aren't right, and it didn't work.
Yeah. So what did they do for you?
Well, they basically gave me one anyway, but it caused quite the delay and a whole bunch of confusion with... the U.S. Border Services, because they had never encountered someone that didn't have normal retinas applying for one of these
really?
Cards.
That surprises me.
Yeah, I have two artificial eyes. I'm not thinking that would work very well either, would it?
You still probably have a retina.
Do you? Or can it? Or maybe
yeah.
are they still? But you probably can't see the retina.
Are they still
you?
Attached? You might have to pop the eye out just to get to the to see the retina, and that may not.
God.
Well, they tell me they have a piece of coral that everything's connected to.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
No, I think you still do have a retina. Retina off of your prematurity, you'll have a messed up retina.
You have
but
it. It's
if
just
you have fake eyes,
not attached.
It's
if you
just
like me.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. These are available include fingerprint readers, handprint readers, iris scanners, which you probably don't have if you have fake eyes, and face recognition devices.
Apple was big on the face recognition, I think, and a lot of the newer laptop manufacturers, I think it was...
My netbook has that, I think.
Wasn't it on Windows 7 you could do some sort of face recognition or something?
Yeah. The last data security strategy we will talk about is file system security. File systems keep track of resources, but some are more secure than others. Only file systems with journals, such as NTFS, can log access by user's date and time. The FAT32 file system lacks both journaling and encryption capabilities. Situations requiring good security usually use a file system such as NTFS, which has these features. There you go, that's file security, guys. The last section we're covering today, since you guys are going to do the preventative maintenance and troubleshooting on your own, is wireless networks, which have their own special set of security problems because you don't need physical access to the network to get the data. You connect wirelessly, so the same goes for an attacker. If your network is open, anyone can connect and can not only use your bandwidth, but also access information that is sent and received, or even shared on your computer. Don't put off securing your wireless network. Apply security settings even before connecting to the device or the device to the network, if at all possible. These are basic security settings that you may want to configure. The first one, which is a definite, is your service set identifier, SSID. You should change the SSID from its default. This SSID is broadcast to all wireless devices. It's the name you see when you attempt to connect to a wireless access point. For
Have
extra security,
you,
yeah, whatever you want.
If it's a home network, have fun with it.
Yep.
Sorry, for funny story, there's one in our apartment building called Virus Factory.
Fair enough.
Oh my. Hey, I think they pretty much are trying to ensure people don't want to join that one, which works, because I don't want to join.
For extra security, you can stop the SSID from broadcasting. In this case, you'll have to enter in the SSID manually because it will not show up in the list of available wireless networks.
Oh, I've got a story with this one. Oh, yeah. Make sure that if you do this, that you note down somewhere that you did it. I went over to somebody's house to fix their wireless network, and they couldn't get any of their machines on the network, and they couldn't find the network, and whenever they looked for the network, it wasn't anywhere around, and I actually interrogated one of the computers that was working, and basically the default network name was Netgear, but the ESSID had been hidden, so once you told all of the machines to join the hidden network, Netgear, everything would go like a mad thing. Unfortunately, I didn't have a copy of Kismet to be sniffing out the network from the working clients. Keep in mind that it also takes about, you know, half a second to sniff out a hidden network if any machine exchanges a packet to or from any other machine on the hidden network. You can sniff it out with Kismet. And if you happen to own an EEPC 701, they're a ripper for that sort of stuff.
So where does one enter the hidden name? I've never seen any edit fields or anything.
Join
like
a wireless
that.
Network. Join an Iris wireless network. Join a hidden wireless network. What is the name of your wireless network? Edit box. Next button. And off it goes.
Right. Yeah, I've never seen the hidden wireless
network. I can look
thing.
In. Hold on. Let me
yeah,
see.
That's where it was, Grace. You actually go connect to a network, and then it says join a hidden network, and then it pops up an edit box that you can key in the ESSID. Just make sure it doesn't disconnect you from the one you're already on, or you'll lose your Ventrilo connectivity. Maybe we should play after lecture.
Oh, no. I'm on wire.
Yeah, if you're using XP, you actually have to go to change advanced settings, I think, and go to the change the order of preferred networks and add one.
Yeah.
I'm not actually seeing it here.
I have actually seen it. You go through the Connect to a Network wizard, and then you go unlisted network, and then it pops up there. We used to have our wireless access point hidden, but once the seventh Mac user came in and went, I can't see the network, I had to go and turn the SSID back on.
Yeah, that's because it's hidden.
That's because it's hidden. Can you just type in Cavi? Oh, I'll unhide it. Here you go.
I'm not sure where. I know you can put it in there.
Yeah, I know you can too. I just am not seeing it, probably because I'm connected to a network right now.
Well, I'm talking about on the Mac. There has to be a way to put it in there too.
Yeah. Oh, there is.
Totally is.
Yeah, but if it doesn't pop up in the You've Got Wireless Networks, they seize up and go, it's not showing up. You've got no wireless. Actually, I should hide it again and see how many people I annoy.
Okay.
Well, actually, I will hide it, Grace, because that way you can find out how to do it with Windows 7 after lecture. I'll bring it back.
Fair enough. You should. Okay. Now, if you mess up even one letter in that SSID, you're not going to connect. So you have to make sure to enter it exactly right.
Is this the point at which I admit to, in 2005, I borrowed a wireless access point and a wireless card, and we spent 4 hours figuring out why we couldn't connect the wireless network to the wireless card, and we finally found the edit field where you keyed the SSID into both, and it all worked like a mad thing. Keep in mind, this was 2005, and wireless was just very new. This was, I think it was SVEC, wireless access points, if anybody remembers those. They were old.
No idea. Okay, you can also use MAC address filtering. What is a MAC address, anybody?
A number that is unique to each device made.
Okay, more specific, please. Is it physical or logical?
Physical. I can't remember what it stands for.
Yes, that's correct. Media access control.
That's all.
Okay, any extra bonus question? How many bits are in a MAC address?
48.
Yes, absolutely right.
You can pick the expiration, student, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, this MAC address, guys, is a really good idea. One of the things you can do is you can go into your wireless access point, and it has a list of MAC addresses, and you can add them to the allow table. It does mean that when your mate comes over with his laptop, you're going to have to add his MAC address in, but it does mean that unusual devices are not just going to be able to jump onto your wireless network and associate. The other thing that's also a really good idea is if your wireless router is separate to your main router, and a lot of you have an all-in-one box, switch it off when you're not using it, okay? Switch it off. Because nobody can connect to a wireless network that's switched off. And if you're going to go away on holidays for 2 weeks and nobody's in the house, shut the wireless network down. Because there is like a radio on-off on a lot of these devices. Switch it off.
I find that because of the prevalence of mobile devices, that MAC address filtering is a pain if you have a lot of people coming over often.
I've got bad news for you.
I can just imagine trying to get the MAC address of the game console that my, you know...
No, it comes up in a list, Sean.
...son's friend wants to...
Yeah, it comes up in a list, Sean. You go, show MAC addresses, and there's a list of them, and then you highlight the one that you've never seen before and go, allow, and it all goes like a magic.
Oh, I thought you had to enter...
No.
You had to manually enter them.
No, on most devices there's this little pop-up GUI list that shows you all of the ones, and even on some of the good routers it shows you what name it thinks it's attached to, so it's like, you know, Jason's Wii, and you go, oh yeah, that's the one I want to allow.
Okay, at the... Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, it can be an administrative nightmare. Great for your organization, sir. An attacker can see any data as it travels over a Wi-Fi network. To prevent this data from being used, you can choose to encrypt your wireless network. You will need to choose the encryption standard you want to use to encode your data. All devices that wish to communicate must use the same encryption standard.
Just another point here. If you are in Australia and you happen to be using Big Pond, the default wireless key is printed on the side of your router. Let's hope that you keep your router in a secure place, or that you're okay with people reading the number off the side if they want to connect to your wireless network.
Yeah, I've also seen a
question. Yep, go ahead.
If I'm connecting to a wireless router and I've got one computer connected by cable, one's wirelessly, and I want to connect a third one, and the key isn't on the router, can you use the same key for the third computer?
Or you have to use the same key.
That's what I thought. So I actually found out how to discover the key, but I'm still having problems, but I haven't exhausted every avenue
well,
yet.
Call me.
Well, what you can do is if you log into the router with the machine that is actually cabled, you can actually change the key so that you know what it is, because most routers will let you connect in, and you can certainly call Grace for tech support on that. But you log into the router and you actually change the wireless key so that you know what they are, and then you go and re-put the key into the other machines and it will all go like a mad thing. If you know what the key is, that makes configuring wireless networks infinitely easier.
I'm actually going to get my friend.
Now, but still, good.
Okay. We probably can help you with that. There are some things where if you're not running a new enough service pack, you need to be running at least SP3 for WPA authentication to work properly, unless you're using the manufacturer drivers. And there are all sorts of other wibbly-wibblies. Also keep in mind that unless you are using WPA encryption, the only portable way of putting keys in WEP that will work on every device is to put the key in hexadecimal. Bletch.
I actually need to get my friend to change hers because her wireless key happens to be the first 10 or so digits of the MAC address, which is also printed on the router.
Oh, great job. What were you going to say, Ron?
The other thing I do on mine is I actually disable the web GUI over Wi-Fi, so you can only get to the GUI of the router by using a cable.
Fantastic idea.
And if you're wanting to know
what does it do?
If you disable the web GUI, in other words, the router configuration pages, over the wireless link, you can't get at them from the wireless network. You must actually plug a cable into the router. Yeah, a lot of routers that come from telecommunications companies are usually cheap and nasty and don't let you do that, though. So you'll have to have a dig around in your settings and see whether your router's capable enough to let you let that happen. The Linksys routers, now manufactured by Cisco Systems, do allow you to do these sorts of things. So there you go. Little advertisement for Linksys there.
The Linksys ones are really good. I like Linksys routers. Okay. The following items are wireless encryption and authentication technologies. Really, really simplified here, guys. Wired Equivalent Privacy, WEP, the first generation security standard for wireless. Attackers quickly discovered that WEP encryption was easy to break. The encryption keys used to encode the messages could be detected by monitoring programs. Once the keys were obtained, messages could easily be decoded. So then we got the next standard. This is completely on a test. Wi-Fi Protected Access, or WPA, an improved version of WEP. It was created as a temporary solution until 802.11i, a security layer for wireless systems, was fully implemented. Now that 802.11i has been ratified, WPA2 has been released. It covers the entire 802.11i standard. WPA uses stronger encryption than WEP encryption.
However, it's still busted, and it takes 3 minutes to get into a WPA network rather than a minute to get into a WEP network, okay? So as long as we realize that WPA is busted, and if you think you're going to turn on WPA because your antiquated Braille device only supports it, and that's the only thing that'll let you get on with, you are not increasing your security very much. So maybe that MAC address security isn't a bad idea after all.
And another security method, Wi-Fi Protected Access 2, or WPA2, an improved version of WPA. This protocol was released to introduce higher levels of security than WPA. WPA2 supports robust encryption, providing government-grade security. WPA2 can be enabled in two versions, personal, password authentication, and enterprise, server authentication. And that's all you get on WPA2, guys.
That's really creepy. I was looking for this book for Carrie, and I just happened to find 802.11 Networks, the Definitive Guide. As we're talking about this, it's really creepy.
That's actually
I was looking for applied cryptography, so that's kind of why I came.
Lightweight extensible authentication protocol. Hey, guys, in your test, LEAP, also called EAP Cisco, a wireless security protocol created by Cisco to address the weakness in WEP and WPA. Leap is a good choice when using Cisco equipment in conjunction with operating systems like Windows and Linux. I bet you guys can guess why that's going to be in your test.
My mobile phone actually supported Leap. I remember seeing it in my team.
Cool.
That was the first time I'd ever seen it. And then when they showed it up, it's like, oh, that's what that is.
I had no idea what it was. Actually, I completely missed that question on the test because it's just been a diagram. Go ahead.
ANO 2.1X is this horrible, well, it's kind of cool, but it uses all of these certification authorities, and you have to set up a certification authority, and then you have to have a master key, and then you have to have subordinate certificates, and then you have a certificate for each workstation. So if Grace thinks MAC address validation is bad, she's just lucky I'm not planning on setting up ANO 2.1X because it's worse. Leap was meant to simplify that greatly, because putting out certificates on all sorts of workstations, they're really difficult to maintain and shuffle out. Imagine if you had to put a private key certificate on every workstation that you wanted to connect to the wireless network. That's 802.1X.
Mm. Okay. Wireless transport layer. This is in your test as well. WTLS is a security layer used in mobile devices that employ the wireless applications protocol WAP. I bet you guys have seen WAP-enabled browsers, haven't you? Mobile devices have a great deal of spare bandwidth, or do not have a great deal of spare bandwidth to devote to security. WTLS was designed to provide security for WAP devices in a bandwidth-efficient manner. Other things you can do to secure your access point are to change the default administrator password for the web interface, you should really do this, and move the web interface off the default IP address. You should also keep your access point in a secure location so it does not walk away or someone doesn't read that key off the side of your device.
One small other thing you can do is, if you have one of these access points with souped up features, turn down the transmit power. You only need enough transmit power to get to the outer edges of your house. There's no point giving half the street Wi-Fi access if you don't have to.
I'd like to know how to do
that. Depends if your router is capable of. A lot of the commercial ones won't let you turn the power down. You'd have to have a look in the interface and see if there is actually a transmit power. But I've actually seen wireless go quite a distance, even when you're only transmitting with 2 milliwatts.
You can log into your web interfaces and have a look. There's some great help pages in those web interfaces usually, and you can look and not touch and not break anything. It's not going to explode if you log in and have a look.
Here's a thought, though, just in case you do want to mess around. There's often an option to back up the configuration file. So click on Backup Configuration File and save it on your computer. And then if it does melt down, you can then put the configuration file back.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Okay, let's see what time we've got. Test today, or do you guys want your test tomorrow?
Still got 12 minutes.
Let's do it now.
Were we going from 8 to 10 or 8 to 9:30 where we're supposed to cut?
8 to 9:30 was supposed to be when we're going, but we didn't. Sorry about that.
Hey, everybody talked. I mean, it happens.
Yeah, I was just curious what we were shooting for. I'm not complaining. I'm just...
That's all right, Karen. The other thing I want to talk to you guys about before the test is what day can we all, everybody who is here, since you're here today, what day can we all commit to be here for a role play?
Whenever.
I need to talk to somebody.
Tell me when it is and I'll be there.
What? You need to talk to somebody?
Yeah, I just need to check with my daughter to make sure she doesn't need me at school.
Okay. Let me know which day you want, Karen. Were you saying next Wednesday? You couldn't be here, I know that.
Are you doing the role play next Wednesday? Is that what you're talking about?
We're trying to decide that. We're trying to figure out when people have commitments or don't have commitments, and we're trying to decide what day.
Hopefully.
Keep us posted, keep Grace posted, and we will shift it around as much as possible so that you can be at the role play, because it's lots of fun.
Are you in next week Wednesday? Okay, Meredith's in next week Wednesday. Carol's not going to be able to be here Wednesday, but that happens. And she's done lots of customer service stuff anyway, social.
And I think I might have a friend who actually does customer support come along. She probably ended up being a customer, but she's probably going to,
cool.
And I might have her come tomorrow as well for the actual lecture, since she was somewhat interested.
tell her I'll be on. And yeah, get her to come on. Set her up.
she likes Carrie's voice.
Yeah.
Anyone else have any commitments? Will next Wednesday do for everybody else?
Should be good.
Yep, so that'd be Tuesday our time. That should be
fine. Yep. Cool. Then we'll have a role play after we do our quick little dip into Module 10, which is a short module, honestly, and usually takes me about an hour to get through. So let's have a quiz, everybody, in your chat windows. And wake up! It's time to wake up, everybody. See how you did.
Oh, should I also mention, in case anybody didn't see my tweets, our wedding recording is up. So before you delete all those Cavi Discuss posts, if you want to hear Grace and I get married, there's a link where you can download it up on Cavi Discuss. For those of you who are there, there's no need to listen to it again unless you really want to. Have you heard it yet, Sean? It was a good recording. I was quite proud of the stereo.
I downloaded it. I listened to it a little bit.
Okay.
I'll probably listen to it.
All right. If you are not in
your
chat
windows...
Just to
hear all the stuff that didn't get transmitted over eventually.
Then you should get into your chat windows now. I'm just grabbing the quiz.
Now, that is a good point. I might have to get it as well then, Sean.
If you get on Twitter, you can get the link. No, it's all right. We'll give you the link.
No, I saw the link. It came across my email.
Oh, yeah, it did.
Yeah, you would have got on Facebook.
No, he's not on Facebook. It came across Cavi Discuss. Funnily enough.
Yeah, but Cassie's on Facebook. Sorry. She would have seen the link.
Fair enough. Yes, she's always on Facebook.
Oh, I like that. Do not touch signs. Do they come in Braille? I'll pay that one.
What was that for?
I'd love to know.
It was on Twitter. There's one of the funny people that posts one-liners, and it was just like, you know, do not touch signs. Do they come in Braille?
Fair enough.
Lovely little quiz that I put up.
You sliced it all out this morning and everything. You
I
were
did.
Late.
I totally was.
Anybody got anything they want to talk about while Grace is looking for her little quizzy?
What you were talking about before with the router configuration stuff, is that all just in that main sort of web interface? Like, that shouldn't be too hard for me to find, because seemingly our wireless
is
a lot less secure than I thought it was.
Well, it's all relative. I mean, it depends on how paranoid you're going to be, but you can go in there and have a look and see what options are around, and... you just go into the web interface and have a read of the pages and then Google up the model of your router and find the book before you make a complete mess of it, because if you take your internet down, it's possible that your flatmates may not be too happy with you, especially if they've got no internet.
Mm. You said a WEP, for instance, you can get into it in about a minute, and a WPA you can get into it in about three. What do you actually get into it with? Like
a computer running little hacky cracky tools. You have
okay.
a little laptop and you wire it up with really good antennas and stuff, and you go driving around the neighborhood busting into people's wireless network and nicking their bandwidth, if you're that sort of person.
Fair enough. Now, I'm not asking specifically for the aim of doing it. I'm asking more to understand, as in if I understand how it's done, then I understand more about how to prevent it being done, is what I mean. So it's third-party tools and stuff that you do it with.
It's not that common. Usually if you've got a WEP password on your network, you are about 90% secure. There aren't that many people who are serious about busting into your networks. You will stop 90 to 95%.
People just see secure and they say, oh, screw it.
Pretty much.